This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As a kid, Nelson George took perverse pride when his neighborhood in Brooklyn was described as the worst ghetto in the country. The motto in Brownsville was, "I'm from the Ville. I never ran, and I never will." But there were passports to the outside world. In his new memoir, he described standing wrapped in front of the Motorola stereo in the living room of his apartment, stacked with his mother's 45s. Music can pull you out of your location, circumstances, and the particulars of your life for as long as you sing along, writes Nelson George. And while he explored the universe with his ears, what saved him, he writes, is writing. The novelist and cultural critic joins us in a moment, and we want to hear today from the writers in our audience. What was it that made you fall in love with words? Was there a moment you knew this was what you were going to do? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the very different legacy of a kid from the other side of New York, Mark Bowden's profile of Arthur Oakes Sulzberger Jr., the publisher of the New York Times. But first, Nelson George's new book is City Kid, a writer's memoir of ghetto life and post-soul success. Today, he joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hey, great to be on.
And your childhood, as you describe it, was so tied up with music. Was there a moment when you realized you would write about music rather than perform it?
Well, I realized that I was a very bad musician. That was kind of the moment when I realized I better write about it. In junior high school, I failed at violin. I failed at piano. I did master briefly the baritone horn, which is not a very popular instrument. And I didn't want to get up early enough to go join the Glee Club. So I ended up just continuing to listen to music and eventually becoming a writer about music.
About music. And what was the first essay into that? How did you start?
Well, I mean, my first conscious memory of wanting to do it was reading a review of the Brothers Johnson album Stomp in Rolling Stone, which is the late 70s, and thinking that the writer for Rolling Stone really didn't understand the context in which the music came out of. I always felt like a lot of the rock critics of the era wrote about black music as if they were writing about Bob Dylan and didn't have enough appreciation for rhythm and the complexities of rhythm. And the fact that these songs were, if they're anything, they were made to be danced to. And so that was sort of the spark I remember. And then I remember submitting an article to Rolling Stone, a review, got a rejection letter. And then I began barraging Robert Christgau at the Village Voice, who is still to this day the dean of American rock critics. And he sent me a couple of nice rejection letters. But I kept plugging away. So by the time I was out of college, around 81, I finally met Bob. And I think I did my first piece for The Voice sometime in 1981.
You wrote you described those bus trips you took from Brooklyn all the way to Jamaica and Queens to go to St. John's College. And there was a fascinating comment you made that you describe yourself as an habitual writer, not an instinctual one. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, I used to read these articles, you know, these books. I read all the biographies. I read a couple of bios of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, John Dos Passos, you know, when I was in my college years. And this idea of writing every day and having a ritual and having a kind of pattern really appealed to me. And so I began writing every day and found, you know, there's a phrase that jazz musicians used to use called woodshedding, which was going out and staying in the woodshed and just practicing you know, every day for several hours. And I feel like writing is like that. I mean, it's not to say that I don't get inspired or you know, but I think that the idea of building a muscle, the way an athlete builds his muscle, is an important part of the writing process. Especially if you want to really, if you want to write books, it's got to be, you have to have developed that kind of, I think, discipline.
It was fascinating. In high school, I always thought of myself as a writer, and later had a writer as a roommate, and began to realize, you know, you got to put your butt in the chair every single day. Writers write.
Well, it's funny. There's this phrase that's later in the book. I interviewed Quincy Jones in the early 80s, and he used the phrase ass power to describe the intensity of Michael Jackson in the studio. And what he meant by that is the ability to come in and put the time in mm-hmm. to create these vocals, to create the background harmonies. All the things that seem spontaneous on the record are very calculated, and they're products of thought and, discipline. And so that phrase, I guess Quincy gave me the framework. He gave me the phrase to use, this ass power phrase. And I apply that to all forms of artistic work. It all entails, sitting your butt down somewhere.
And it all involves, and work is what it is. But there's another aspect of it that you also write about in your book, and that is ambition. At the end of the 70s, you write, you were possessed by ambition.
Well, I mean, I wanted to be something. I wanted to make my name mean something. And, when you come from, coming from far out in Brooklyn, I come out from the far, far end of Brooklyn, Brownsville in East New York. You might as well be from Des Moines, Iowa, in terms of Manhattan. It's a long ride there. Culturally, it's worlds away. So to make your mark in that town, you have to really make a commitment to a certain kind of almost obsessed possession. I mean, when you meet young people who come to New York in their 20s, they come there to win. They come there to make something of themselves. And one of the things that makes New York, New York, is that overwhelming sense of ambition and desire to make a mark. I don't think people go to New York to find a nice lifestyle.
No.
Or to get married. They go there to do something that they've dreamed of doing since they were little kids.
I'd just like to read that passage I was referring to. Looking back through my notebook pages from the era, I see I ached to do something, to be someone, to make my name mean more than it had when my father and grandfather were the only Nelson Georges in the world. I'd roll around in my bed at night, frustrated if I hadn't worked hard enough or anxious if I hadn't thought I worked well. I think there was a white writer out there who was already out ahead of me who could afford to relax, and I'd jump out of bed and start writing. I don't think I was at rest the entire decade. The dawn of the 80s would inaugurate a new era in my life and happily in the city that I loved. And that is the passion to put things down on paper.
Yeah, I still, right now, I'm in your control room, your studio, and I have a little notebook, a little notepad, a little piece of paper in front of me with a pen, because you never know. And, things come to you. And one of the great things that I learned was the subconscious. I think that's a huge part of, I guess, any artistic practice is, it's funny, when people say they're blocked, I always say, you're blocked about something. You may be blocked about this particular piece of work that you're working on, mm-hmm. but you should write something else. Do not write. Just shift the gears. Continue to keep your confidence up. And what I often find is that eventually what I was writing that was different from the main job ends up somehow flowing back into what I really wanted to write, that the subconscious works on your behalf very often.
We're talking with the writer Nelson George about how he got started. He's written, of course, novels and a lot of cultural criticism as well. He's also got a new memoir out called City Kid, a writer's memoir of ghetto life and post-soul success. We want to talk with writers in our audience today about the moment they realized this was what they were going to do, how they got started. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Josh is on the line with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Actually, the moment that I started writing, I actually come from a very different background than your guest today. I come from a town of about 300 people. It's called Hamilton, Kansas, in the middle of southeast Kansas. So, we're 30 miles from the nearest supermarket, and the power in our area was such to where during a rainstorm or if a squirrel got fried by the electricity, we'd be out for at least 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
There was quite a bit of times when I was growing up when my folks would sit around and we had a wood stove and they read by candlelight of Edgar Allan Poe. And, my dad was a huge Edward Abbey fan. So we got tooled in the Monkey Wrench Gang, the Fool's Progress, all those kinds of things. And, just seeing that people from rural backgrounds, from poor areas that were able to, lend a voice to those that didn't really have the bullhorns is kind of what inspired me to get into the industry.
And what do you do now?
I'm actually at KU working on a master's in creative writing and journalism. I do a blog where I go and find rural families, like personal interest stories. I'll cover eight-man football. I'll go out and cover the conditions of the Ogallala Aquifer out in western Kansas, just offbeat things that you don't really see picked up in mainstream.
But those words that you picked up from your parents, from those books that they read, they're the ones that got you interested. It's interesting, Nelson George, I don't think you write about your parents reading to you. Of course, your father left when you were pretty young, but you remember the words that you started to gather off all of those 45 records and the album covers on the LPs, the words that started to tell you the names and the stories about the music that you ended up writing so much about.
Well, yeah, but I mean, to go back to his point about the books, I would say the thing, my mother went to night school when I was she would work during the day and go to night school. She'd bring home all these books she would have. And, I mean, I got turned on to, I remember reading James Joyce when I was a teenager. Sharon Anderson's Wineville, Ohio. I think it's Wineville, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. I think it is.
When I was, a kid, because it was a book that my mother was reading. I remember going to the Literary Guild. I think I read about that in the book, and getting this whole volumes of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Faulkner through the Literary Guild. You could get, for $1, you could get a free membership, and I ordered all these books through it. And so, I mean, the idea of reading things that inspire you that are outside your experience, are it's crucial to, I think, stimulating you to see the world larger. The album covers and knowing that Motown was in Detroit or Stax was in Memphis gave me a sense of the country is a bigger place, and that around this country there were these different places where music was different from what I heard in New York. So I think all these things tie together and really stimulate you.
Josh, thanks very much. Good luck with your project.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. We're talking with Nelson George today about his memoir and about, well, a writer's birth. What was yours? If you're a writer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. Nelson George's new memoir, City Kid, is a tour of the housing projects he grew up in, the small glories of city life. He played stickball with Willie Randolph, and the music that entranced him with words and art. If you'd like to read an excerpt from the book and why Nelson George recommends standing upstairs instead of down on the floor at a hip-hop show, you can read an excerpt from his book at our website, npr.org/talk. And we want to hear from you. What was it that made you fall in love with words? Was there a moment you knew you were going to be a writer? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go to Doug, and Doug's with us from Dayton, Ohio.
Neil, great show. Mr. George, like you, I grew up really being into music, a lot of hip-hop and a lot of punk and rock and things like that. Read vociferously, became a writer recently. When I was 16, I read a book called Boy's Life by Robert R. McCammon, and he combined that literary style with language that was clearly borrowed from rock and roll idioms and things like that, and it really opened my eyes that you could combine those two different languages, that sort of storytelling style with the I don't know, shuck and jive of popular music. I think that really inspired me to try and do it myself, and I'm so glad it did. It changed my life.
I mean, it's nothing like this is not a golden age for music criticism, but, you know, people like Lester Bangs, Dave Marsh, Creel Marcus's brilliant book, Mystery Train, one of the greatest books about rock and roll ever. Leroy Jones's Blues People. I mean, you know, when you can have a writer who has a great grasp of language and metaphor, writing about music, which is already, you know, for casual listeners, intangible, it can be magical. And, you know, that combination of slang and sort of erudite commentary, when it works, it's magical.
Did you think of yourself, Nelson, as a hip-hop writer?
No. I'm a writer about black culture. Hip-hop's a subset of black culture. It's not, its own thing. I mean, I stood out. My dream was to write a book about Motown, which I did in 1985. And my next book's A Deaf Rhythm and Blues. All the time, hip-hop was something I was writing about that was developing and new. But there are people who see themselves as hip-hop writers. I see myself as a writer about American culture, particularly African-American culture.
And, Doug, do you think of yourself as a rock and roll writer?
No, I wouldn't say so, but it's such a important part of my life, I think, that I've borrowed pretty intensively from that language in my writing.
All right. And you're writing now, Doug?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm working on my first novel right now.
Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Chris, and Chris calling from Denver.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me on. I wanted to share my first real writer's moment happened much later in life than I expected, even though I've been living as a writer for many decades. I've been a journalist since about seventh grade and write magazine articles and different things now for money. However, I never really understood my writer's voice until I actually lost my physical voice during a surgical mishap, during a thyroidectomy, a little over a year ago, actually. And when I suddenly didn't have my physical voice anymore, the voice in my head became very, very loud. And I was able to listen a little bit more because the noise of everything had drowned out completely to this impenetrable silence. And it was a very incredible experience, and I was actually told I would never speak again by my surgeon. And it took about 8 months of voice therapy and hypnotherapy and things like that to bring the physical voice back. But the most extraordinary thing happened, and that was that my writing became incredibly enhanced by the missing physical voice.
As if one... ability grew with the loss of the other.
It was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary.
And, that's a profound story.
At the time, I've had many books in my head that I've wanted to speak, but I haven't been quiet enough to actually hear them. And I was able to finish my first children's book this year, which I hope to get published. But it's been in my head for a long, long time. So it was a really unique experience for me, and it took actually, you know, kind of shutting up to be able to hear it.
I'm sure none of your relatives will ever bring that up.
Yeah, I'm sure they won't. They're too kind.
It's interesting. I find, and I wonder if you think this is true, Nelson George, a lot of writers talk to themselves.
Well, I mean, it is a very internal process. I mean, very often you will be out a loud club or at dinner or at a movie theater or just walking down the street and you will hear a sentence or a word or an image that will, you know, that's the start of something or it's the part of something that you were missing that you hadn't addressed yet. So, you know, one thing that you learn a lot, I do a lot of yoga, you know, is the idea of stillness and keeping the mind quiet. And, it's a hard thing to do in the Twitter, CNN, 24 News cycle world we live in to be quiet and to be able to really hear yourself because there's so much noise in the environment.
Do you find yourself, and I wonder, Chris, if this is true for you too, do you find yourself suddenly, you know, sitting bolt upright in bed some nights and saying the word that happened to me after I'd written a piece and about three nights later I woke up and said the word was scud. I was looking for the verb to scud and it just came to me then. And you know, of course it was way late. The piece had already been on the radio.
Right. That happens a lot. But I find even more, I'll be trying to turn a phrase in my mind and I'll go over it and over it and over it. And even if I try to speak it out loud, it doesn't work. But often those quiet moments, and I do yoga also, in the middle of the night or during yoga or during a deep meditation, it will just come to me. And it opens up almost like a flower. It's a beautiful moment.
But I've had some great, great ideas doing Shavasana.
Yeah.
You know, you're laying there, you've done the classes, and then something will run into your mind because your mind has been clear for 90 minutes, basically.
Exactly.
So it's a one. I mean, that idea of the subconscious and letting the subconscious work for you is a really important idea, I think.
Absolutely. It's the corpse pose, I think, is the Western term. where you just everything becomes silent and all of your senses are open, completely open to experience, and then it all opens up.
That third eye starts twitching.
Chris, good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go to Daniel. Daniel with us from Louisville.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. George. Great to hear you today. I have been a poet and playwright for about 25 years, and I can remember exactly the moment that started. I was in freshman English in high school. Our teacher was sharing with us the poem Richard Cory by Edwin Arlington Robinson. And it has this ironic ending at that very last line when Richard Cory goes home and shoots himself through the head. It was like a shot of lightning ran down my spine. And I thought, that's power. I need to do that. And I've been at it ever since.
Power. It happens.
Yeah. The power to excite people, to thrill people, to, get their emotions to turn like that?
Absolutely. And also, the meaning of that poem and the rhyme just hit the right place. I think I really appreciated the idea of craft and the idea that you could, almost like a sculptor in stone or clay, you could create these artifacts out of words. And part of the pleasure for me is really just sort of being the architect of a piece and making everything work the way it should and not having a wasted syllable. It's a great challenge that I would tinker with on my own, kind of the way folks do a crossword puzzle. It's just fascinating to do, to work at being that precise.
Craft is an interesting word, Nelson George.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that, it's funny, as I was starting to move from doing journalism to try and write longer nonfiction books, one of the things I had to really learn was theme and the idea that it's not simply constructing all these words together and getting all these facts, which you do as a journalist, but finding a larger unifying idea or ideas that then animate the material and give it a point of view. Of all the artists I've been around, the thing that seems to separate them is this point of view, this ability to bring themselves to the material and also to thematically organize material around ideas. It's like the beginning of The Godfather, when there's that great monologue that is given by The Undertaker, where he talks about America, he talks about family, he talks about revenge. And in a very simple monologue that opens The Godfather, he basically sets up the entire theme for The Godfather saga. And so theme, when used properly, can really take material that, you know, a gangster movie, and give it a larger feel, a larger sense of importance.
Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. There's another aspect. You started writing journalism. You started writing about artists. Then you started writing these nonfiction books. Then you started writing novels. And was there a conscious turn there to saying, I am not writing about artists. I am writing, something that could be, if I do it well, art?
Well, I got into writing because I wanted to be Hemingway. And then I realized, that's a little harder than I thought it would be.
That's a steep mountain, yeah.
And I began becoming – I actually did journalism, interesting enough, initially to meet more people because I felt like you could ask people questions and begin conversations. You have a license as a journalist to be inquisitive. And that sort of led me on that road, and then the music kind of came together. Doing fiction was really liberating and fun. And very satisfying in a lot of ways that nonfiction isn't, but it is a different craft. I mean, I think the two things do use different tools. I feel like I didn't really become a really true fictional storyteller, and I think in the strongest way until I started working in film, actually. And I directed a film about 2-3 years ago now with Queen Latifah called Life Support, a film about HIV.
About your sister.
Based on my sister's life. And that experience of taking real stuff but also finding a narrative way to tell it for a large group of people was really exciting. And I think the process of learning how to tell stories is ongoing. And so craft are the techniques you use to tell your story best. You learn to apply those more and more as time goes on.
It was interesting, the experience of making that picture in Brooklyn took you in some ways also on a tour of many of the neighborhoods, the ones you grew up in and the ones that you live in now.
Yeah, I mean, we shot Life Support in Fort Greene, where I've lived for now 20, 25 years, and we shot a lot of it, or in Brownsville, which is the neighborhood I grew up in, the last scene in the film was shot on a rooftop at a private school in Brownsville. And in the background, you can see the projects I grew up in. So it was very full circle in every respect. In some ways, the memoir City Kid is the backstory to the film, Life Support. So the two things for me are very much linked. I don't think I could have really finished the memoir City Kid without having done the film, because the film gave me a sense of closure about a lot of issues.
We're talking with Nelson George about his book. He just mentioned the title, City Kid, A Writer's Memoir of Ghetto Life and Post-Soul Success. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Natalie. Natalie with us from Davis in California.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I met Nelson, I guess, back in the 80s. I was living in Fort Greene also, and I decided to get into writing because he told me we had enough actresses. Yes, he did. I haven't seen him in years. Ran into him in Atlanta back in 96, I believe. But anyway, I was living in Fort Greene. It was just a wonderful time, and I saw everything Spike ever did, and I met Nelson, I think, after I saw Menace to Society. So when I started seeing his films, I decided he was right. There were enough actresses, and I was going to go towards writing.
That's hilarious.
And I'm trying to catch up with Donald Bogle. He does a lot of black film critique. I think I'm pronouncing the name right.
Donald Bogle.
Bogle, yeah. So I just wanted to say hello to you because you encouraged me, and I'm going for it now years later.
How's the writing working out, Natalie?
Well, I'm a parent with three children, so
you get
busy. Yeah.
Little time.
Yeah.
Little
yeah.
time. Well, yeah, go
well,
ahead.
Nice to see you again, Natalie. That's a great story. I hope I didn't steer you wrong.
No, you didn't. Actually, it was at this time when I was working on Crooklyn as an extra, and you were saying to me, why don't you write? Why don't you write? And I thought, you know what? Why don't I write? So I just wanted to call in and say that I've enjoyed your work. And I saw you on TV the other day when you did Soul Cities. You came
right
to my hometown in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm here now, actually.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. Yeah. So you've got some other Chinese restaurants to check out also.
Absolutely.
Anyway, it's nice talking to you. I just want to let you know you inspired me back in the day.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck, Natalie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I also need...
That's a great story.
It is a great story. We just have a couple of minutes left, but we share a trait which is very unusual in American society today, and that is that neither of us drive.
Right.
And I have found that as a non-driver, you have to develop verbal skills and social skills to convince people to drive you where you need to go.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's I think I dated a long time just to have a driver. In retrospect, but
I'm sure she's so proud.
Well, you know, it's really funny about not driving here is that I don't know. You know, people look at you. I'm about to go to Los Angeles, so you know that I'm really weird there.
You bet.
But it's funny about that. There's a select group of us who've decided not to do that for whatever reasons, and it's funny because I walk a lot. Even in a city like LA, I will walk places, and Los Angeles on foot is a completely different city than in the car, because there's actually a lot going on, but you'd never know it because no one really looks outside their window. They're all looking on the road. So it's been one of those weird defining things about my life, and I don't ever think it was a conscious decision never to learn how to drive. It just sort of happened, and I felt like, what am I going to do? I need to do it now? So who knows? I still may learn how to drive eventually.
It's one of those things that does define the term city kid, though.
Absolutely.
Nelson, I wanted to end with this email we got from Tyler. I teach writing at Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu. I use Mr. George's criticism in my freshman composition classes. His essays have been very inspirational to my students. In particular, they force my students to take academic writing seriously to show that it can be as relevant and compelling as any story or poem. Also, George's work helps inspire my students to take their own experience of music and pop culture seriously to show that critical thinking was not just for Shakespeare, Beethoven, etc. I appreciate all his amazing work.
Oh, that's lovely. That's from Hawaii?
That's from Hawaii.
That's amazing.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Nelson George joined us today from the studios of KQED, our member station in San Francisco. His new book, again, is City Kid, A Writer's Memoir of Ghetto Life and Post-Soul Success. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Mark Bowden, who's got a new profile in Vanity Fair magazine of a kid who also grew up in New York City. Very different experience. He ended up inheriting the job as publisher of the New York Times. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.